Oh God, it's too bloody hot to be doing this, but here we are anyway. Welcome to the Strange and Deadly Show. This is a podcast dedicated to the Section 3 list, cachet films related to Britain's video nasties. We prep these films based on a theme and then discuss and review them for your and hopefully our entertainment. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or any good podcatcher, and you can find more information about us and the other shows on the network over at gentlemansgrindhouserecords.com. We'll tell you how you can get feedback, comments and questions to us over at the end of the show. If I'm still alive, and I don't know if I will be, because it is boiling hot in England at the moment. Tom, what say you?
I say hello, and I'm very hot as well. I'm just not made for this heat, Chris. But we'll soldier on, as always, we'll soldier on.
Which is a funny thing, because you're a fitter man than I, yet I'm sitting here like a big blubbery... Do you know what? I'm like a big old bollock, and and that's not the way I want to be, Tom. But you, fine chiseled man, I would imagine the sweat just runs off your skin like... You know, like you're a statue or something.
Well, it does. You know, I like to oil myself up before the Strange and Deadly Show. You know that. So the sweat just sort of runs off me like a lovely little stream.
Ooh, hang on. I'm getting very, very excited at the moment. But I must ignore it, Tom. I must ignore my burgeoning feelings for you as we move forward, because here we are once again on the Strange and Deadly Show, covering... the films we love. We're about a week late because unfortunately I had some health issues the other week that I had to deal with, and I'm still dealing with them, and some pain and things like that. Not something I really want to do, because we've been in a nice sort of rhythm lately getting these shows done. And as we move towards the end, believe it or not, we're not that far away from finishing the Section 3 list. So sorry about the delay, but we're here once again. You've been watching anything lately, Tom? Anything we should know about?
I've started Stranger Things. That seems to be what everyone's talking about at the moment. I'm trying to get it done before some idiot ruins it for me. I've started to see a few articles just then on Twitter popping up. What does the end of Stranger Things mean?
Yeah.
I was like, hold on, you're showing me a picture there. Fuck off, you know, I haven't watched it yet. So I'm trying to watch it quickly and get it done. So that's it mainly. What about you?
Now, I absolutely love Stranger Things, by the way. I really enjoyed that. And I would imagine you'd probably like it too, because you're a big fan of The Twilight Zone, of course. You have the podcast, and it, you know, in many ways it fits in with that. And then there's obviously the Stephen King influences. There's a bit of John Carpenter, Steven Spielberg, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I sort of watched that quite recently. Myself, and it's a terrible thing, isn't it, when, because that show really has only come out very, very recently, and it's too soon, I think, to start throwing spoilers out there for that sort of thing. You know, I mean, I think there's got to be, I always sort of think that you should leave at least, you know, a year or I'm not saying that people shouldn't write articles or share opinions on that, but to not make spoilers so incredibly public, because you're going to be exposed to it at some point, aren't you? It's inevitable.
Well, that's the thing. A picture might pop up, and some of these articles that I've seen do include pictures of scenes that I haven't seen yet, and they might think, oh, well, you know, no one's, this won't mean anything to anyone who hasn't seen it yet. But, you know, your mind joins the dots sometimes, doesn't it? And you'll be watching something and then say, oh, well, maybe that leads to that scene that I've seen the picture of. So, you know, it's just, I guess it's the world we live in, and I don't have to go on social media. But you're right, it seems like that show has not long come out. I don't know how long it's come out for, but I think if you put it on like a normal weekly show, it might not even be at its end yet. And not all of us have got the time to sit and binge shows over, you know, a day or two. You know, I tend to, if I'm lucky, I'll do an episode every couple of days, you know, because that's just the way life is. But anyway, you know, it's a shame. It's a shame.
It definitely is. I mean, you look at something like the Game of Thrones, for example. People can't wait to spoil Game of Thrones for you. Like my best friend is going through it at the moment, and he, you know, he was just out with a couple of mates the other day, and somebody just started spoiling the whole bloody thing for him, because it's almost as if people can't stand the fact that they know something that you don't, and it's like they have to let you in on it. And Stranger Things is definitely one of those things. That's why I binged it, because I didn't want it to be spoiled. And one of the great benefits of something like Netflix, for example, is a lot of these Netflix original shows, they throw the whole lot up there in one go. So you can, and so really, yeah. you're the one who's in control of how you want to consume your entertainment. And the fact that for many of these things, we can't go on, you know, we have to be careful of Twitter sometimes. We have to be careful of going on to, you know, I've had things spoiled for me just going on to like an article on the internet that isn't even anything to do with that particular subject. Someone will just go in there and spoil it for me. You know, somebody almost spoiled The Force Awakens for me, and a really key spoiler in that. It turned out that the spoiler was a fake one, but it still made me think, well, fuck, you've just spoiled something before I go and see it. So it's a bit of a shame. I'm not sure how this turned into a thing on a rant about spoilers, but you know, but I'm glad you're going through that show anyway, Tom, to sort of button that up, because I think it's a really good show. I'd be interested to hear what you think about it when it's all said and done. A very interesting show that sort of recaptures a lot of things that I love about the 80s and about 80s media and sort of and kids adventure films and the Goonies and, and films like that that I'm a big fan of. So and as for me, you know, I've been watching just a bunch of really random stuff, really. I watched, finally got to see Batman v Superman, the two cuts of that, and thought it was fine. You know, thought it was fine. Not terrible by any means, but quite flawed. Lots and lots of problems. I know you, Tom, was sort of, you didn't think it was bad, did you? You thought it was, you know, it was fine.
I thought it was okay. I mean, you know, we could talk about this all night kind of thing. I didn't get on board with the hate so much. And I think that's part of it, because there was so much hate and vitriol out there. You know, once I saw it, I was like, no, it's not that bad, you know. And I didn't love it, which is a shame, because this should be my movie, you know what I mean? It should be the thing that I pick up and just love the crap out of it, but it's not. There's problems there in that DC universe, and they do need to be fixed. But, you know, let's not go into that, because we could be here all night.
That's a problem for another podcast. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But you're right. It's a very messy film, but the extended cut of it, I think, is better. But still not great. But I'm sure there's some people listening to this who are diehard horror fans who are like, "What is this nonsense?" You know, what is this nonsense they speak? But Tom and I are sort of pretty big superhero geeks, and so we do tend to fill up our lives with at least a good chunk of that. But anyway, Tom, forget about all that. Why don't you tell us what's coming up on this week's show? What is it?
This time we're talking about classic monsters. Now, the reason we titled it that is back through the history of cinema, back to the Universal days, we've had mummy movies, we've had vampire movies, we've had werewolf movies, Frankenstein's monster, and each generation seems to get their own version of it. You know, there was Universal, there was Hammer, and then we come to the 70s and early 80s, Section 3 time, where they have their own versions of the werewolf story, the mummy story, and there were probably better, I don't want to say better, but more high-profile versions of the story than these, maybe. Mm-hmm. But this is a Section 3 list, and this is what we've got. We've got Dawn of the Mummy and Werewolf Woman, two of the more sort of low-rent versions of the classic monsters.
Yeah, the basement dwellers of the entire movement. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Section 3 list has got a bit of everything, hasn't it? We've seen all sorts of different films on this list. And so it's not a huge surprise that the classic monsters were going to be covered in this. Now, I have to say that I expected these films to be sort of more reflective of the classic Universal monsters. I don't know why that is. I hadn't seen either of these films before, so I was expecting that. And it's interesting what we actually got. But tell us about Dawn of the Mummy, Tom.
Okay, Dawn of the Mummy, released in 1981, a.k.a. nothing. Is this a Section 3 film with only one title? Possibly.
It isn't, but all of the other titles were in a foreign language, Tom. And I only tend to include the ones that have an alternative English title. So.
Okay, directed by Frank Agrama. Starring George Peck, Brenda Seymour, Schneider, Barry Sattles, John Salvo. So an all-star lineup there. Then we open in 3000 BC as the cruel and sadistic Egyptian pharaoh Safiraman is on horseback finding common folk to enslave. The pharaoh later dies and is mummified and buried in a tomb, along with his cache of gold treasure. It is declared that should the tomb ever be disturbed, a curse will be unleashed, and Sefiraman's army of the undead will rise and kill. We flash forward to present-day Egypt to the sound of dynamite blasting open the entrance to the tomb. There's a group of three tomb raiders led by crazy American Rick, who has heard of the treasure buried there and wants his share of the gold. They're warned by Xena, who was present at Sefiraman's burial and is still alive, but now elderly, to stay away, lest they awake the pharaoh and bring about the curse. The men don't listen and scare her off with gunshots fired into the air while Rick and his men sleep. Three prospective thieves arrive and head into the tomb, hoping to beat the men to the punch, but they're quickly set upon by poisonous gas which burns and melts their faces. A group of fashion models fly in from New York to tour parts of Egypt and use some of the locations for shooting. The group, comprised chiefly of girls with two men serving as male model and photographer, camp out near the cursed tomb, though have no knowledge of it at first. It isn't until one of Rick's men shoots at them in a state of panic that the group becomes aware of something happening at the tomb. Rick quickly comes out and apologizes, hoping that that will be enough to dissuade them from entering the tomb to see what they're doing, but it doesn't work. Yes, because if someone's shooting at you, you then go and investigate.
Absolutely.
The group comes in and quickly realizes that the tomb would make a fantastic setting for new pictures, and with Rick's reluctant blessing, they set up inside. Over the next few days, the group has fun inside the tomb while Rick anxiously awaits their departure. He's relieved that none of them seem to know of or be after the treasure. Nobody seems to be aware that Sefiraman's rags are being slowly burned through, which culminates with the pharaoh rising back to life. His awakening brings his undead army back from the sands, ready to feast on human flesh. Most of the group remain camped nearby. A few of them journey to the nearby town to enjoy some smoke and buy jewelry. However, the pharaoh's zombies manage to make it there and kill Rick's partner. When Rick discovers the body, he turns mad, realizing that the talk of the curse was indeed true. He hurries back to the tomb and discovers a hidden chamber that contains the gold he so desperately wanted, but meets his end when the pharaoh strangles and beheads him. So begins an assault on the town and nearby areas as the zombies and the pharaoh live up to their word and begin taking down the townspeople, gutting and eating them. It's now up to the remaining members of the American models to band together and work out a way to defeat the undead before they too are consumed.
Sefiraman, you are alive. You have risen. You are alive. Sefiraman, you have returned to rule again. Your kingdom awaits. You're alive. Sefiraman. Sefiraman, you're alive. Sefiraman. I'm so happy, Sefiraman. You're alive. No. No, Sefiraman. It is my fault. Your armies of the dead will rise. They will rise.
Chris, Dawn of the Mummy, what do you think of this one?
Oh boy, this is some Z level trash, isn't it, Tom? It's bottom of the barrel stuff right here. Interesting, really, because we covered a film quite a while ago when we did a double bill of zombie movies called Oasis of the Zombies, which was set in the desert and was incredibly boring, if you remember rightly. This, I think, somehow manages to be even more bottom of the barrel than that is. And yet, I think has a couple of moments in it where it sort of shines just a little bit. The problem with it, as I think we're going to get into as we go through the plot, is that it has, a really tedious middle section to it where it really slows down in quite an aggravating way. I think it, in terms of sort of characters and things like that, everybody in this movie, almost everybody, is an idiot, which doesn't help. You want somebody to root for. And I think it's one of those mistakes, really, that people sometimes make, in that they sort of put together a group of people and want to kill them off, and so make them as annoying as humanly possible. And there's nothing that's particularly redeeming about them. And I think that's the problem with this, is that it's just, you know, our quote-unquote heroes, if you like, are basically just a bunch of really self-obsessed models. And so you have that situation where they're quite unlikable for the most part. And you know, we're sort of lumbered with them for most of the movie. But there's one character who stood out to me as a major highlight here, really. If everybody, because most of the other characters are really underdeveloped. I mean, I would struggle, to be honest with you, to name any of the characters in the movie apart from this particular person. But this one character really stood out for being just utterly, utterly, utterly bonkers, and saved it for me in a couple of moments here, because some of it I think is quite boring. But some definite highlights, a couple of bits that reminded me of sort of some of the Italian splatterfests that I know you and I like, you know, in a Fulci sort of way. Not even that well, you know, particularly well kind of defined and polished, but there are moments. But for the most part, you know, I know there are some people who are going to listen to this who really love this movie, and I'm definitely not going to say that. I don't think it's very good. Well, it's a rubbish movie, but it's got a couple of bits in it that I thought were kind of decent. What say you?
Yeah, it's a funny one, really, because the highs of it are really quite high sometimes. You know, you've got the location, you've got a soundtrack which at times is just utter cheese,
yeah,
and at times you're just like, oh, this is actually pretty good. You know, I'd love to listen to the soundtrack in isolation to see what I think of it. You're right that people give the likes of Friday the 13th a hard time for having, you know, paper-thin characters. Well, if they're paper-thin, these guys are, like, microscopic, because they are just such nothing characters. And, you know, I don't need, because look, the level of films that we're looking at here, I don't need wonderfully written characters, but I need something,
yeah,
you know, something to latch onto. And just to peek behind the curtain a little bit, when we do this show, we include a little clip of the movie, don't we, at the start of our reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm watching the movies, if something jumps out at me as, okay, that's a nice little bit of dialogue, I'll use that as the opener. With this, it was just like, God, there's nothing here, because people just don't say anything throughout the movie. They talk, but it's just such meaningless bollocks that, you know, I couldn't find anything to use, you know. So God knows what I'm going to use for it. But you're right. That midsection was tedious, which is a shame, because we'll get to the ending, but the ending just seems, everything seems to be at the end,
yeah,
you know. And it's like, whoa, where did this come from? You know, this is really cool. But throughout it, it's just, you know, highs and lows, mainly lows for me, which is a shame, because when it's good, it seems to really get pretty good.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it has more highlights than something like Oasis of the Zombies, like I said at the beginning there. I think it does have, because that movie I just found almost irredeemable throughout. And this has got a few of those moments. I suppose, really, sort of going back to the characters, I know it's been a source of criticism of us in the past that, you know, I know somebody said a long time ago on Twitter, I can't remember who it was, but, you know, you're looking at these films as if they're trying to be the Seventh Seal or something like that. And that's not the case. It's not that I want or even expect to be, you know, really great dialogue and really great well-written characters, but I like somebody to like, if you know what I mean. I like to root for somebody, and that's the way I've always been, you know, ever since I was a kid, really. Get that one character, or perhaps even more than one, but certainly that one character you can really root for. And you look at it in, you know, Ash in Evil Dead, for example. I'm not saying there necessarily needs to be a character like that, but there needs to be something there. And I've just found a lot of these people incredibly bland, really. I guess it, you know, it's not a thing that is necessarily shared, or a feeling that's necessarily shared by everybody, because, like I said, we've got a few people who really, really love this film. I think Amanda, who has written some feedback that we're going to get to later on, is a huge fan and seems to see things in this that we're not seeing for whatever reason. It's one of those things, isn't it? You know, it's opinions. We're all wired in different ways. You can sit 10 people down in front of the same movie, and those 10 people may all have a completely different take on the movie, and they saw the same thing. So it is one of those things. But there are some really... I mean, this is cheesetastic, isn't it? In almost every way. This is Gorgonzola, Tom. I mean, this is... And there are some characters here that I quite enjoyed. I mean, the old woman, what was her name? Xena, who is this sort of high priestess character at the beginning of the movie. Because we've got this pharaoh who is, we can see, everybody right at the beginning here in the 3000 BC section, they all look like they're wearing costume from the costume shop down the road. Let's be honest with it. None of it's looking particularly realistic. And we just basically see the pharaoh on horseback with a couple of his evil cronies kidnapping people and enslaving them. And then very quickly we get the scene of him in the tomb there, and we've got this woman Xena. And for some reason you flash forward from the 3000 BC period to now, and she's now an elderly woman. But it's never actually explained why she's still alive. I'm not quite... How did she end up in 1981? I'm not quite clear on that. One of the funniest thing about it is that she must say it. There's a couple of things in this movie that if you're a drinker, if you're somebody who enjoys a bit of wine or perhaps a good old beer or a shot of whiskey or something, take a drink for two particular things. First of all, take a drink every time this woman says, "They will rise and kill, rise and kill." Right, take a drink every time that happens. Worse than that, I would say, and this is when liver poisoning might set in, alcohol poisoning's on the horizon. Take a drink every time somebody says, "Gold, gold, gold," enthusiastically, because people say the word gold so many times in this, Tom. It, infuriatingly so, I would say.
It's like a 70s, you know, the cast of a 70s chewing gum commercial just put into a film, or like a shampoo commercial or something. Just extremely shallow. And there's one guy, I think his name is Rick, the treasure hunter, who looks like a sort of deranged version of Fred from Scooby-Doo. You know, there's him as well, but he's pretty much the only one I remember. And we've got the main photographer guy, and what happens is we have him and his models coming and photographing, you know, in the desert next to the pyramids and all this business. And when they discover the tomb, which in itself is a crazy scene, because one of Rick's guys starts shooting at them. It's what I alluded to before. And they're all jumping for cover. And then when he stops, Rick comes out and he's like, I'm sorry. And they're all like, "Well, we're coming in." And it's like, hold on. The guy was just shooting at you, and you're approaching them and going into the tomb. But then when they get in the tomb, the photographer guy is like, "Oh my God, we're going to take loads of pictures here. It's going to make us a ton of money. It's really going to put us on the map." And it's like, why? Why is this going to put you on the map? You know, it's like, do you remember that old 80s movie Mannequin?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Where they were making these amazing shop windows, and people were all out in the street looking at these shop windows, and everyone was like, "Oh my God, it's fantastic. Look at those shop windows." And it's like, no, the shop windows, no one gives a shit about those things. You know what I mean? They might look for a second and go, but no one's crowding around the shop window. Same here. No one's going to be like, "Oh my God, look at these models in a tomb. It's amazing." And but to them, it's just like the best thing in the world, isn't it?
Well, can you imagine like picking up a magazine, which presumably where these shots would feature? Of course, I would imagine most of the film has been destroyed, so there's no chance of that happening. But let's imagine that these pictures got printed somewhere. Can you imagine like a bunch of models next to some crusty old mummy in a tomb? Like it wouldn't happen, would it? Unless it was like in Fangoria or something, like, you know, you wouldn't expect it. And also, I mean, let's be honest about it. Why would you need to, based on the surroundings that they're shooting in, which is basically a couple of women and this guy, this dark-haired guy, leaning up against a pillar, You could have shot this in your back garden in New York. Why did you need to fly to Egypt for that? It doesn't make a lot of sense. But you've touched on something there that's who I was referring to when I was saying that there's one particular character that was a major highlight for me, and that is the character of Rick, who is played by George Peck. Who,
right.
I would assume based on that name that he probably is an American actor. To be honest with you, I didn't actually look at that, but certainly he's playing an American in this. It has got to be one of the most maniacal, schizo performances I've seen in a movie in quite some time. They must have shot this boy up with something, Tom, before they started filming, because every time his eyes go really weird and psychotic. Every time he talks about the gold, it's like he's almost got a sort of a sexual interest in gold. There's something weird, like that. There's that point where he finds the hidden chamber and he sort of peeks in and he's like, oh, the gold's there. And he leans up against the wall and he's almost touching himself. And I'm like, it's a bizarre, all over the place, but weirdly memorable performance, isn't it?
You're right. He is probably the most the highlight of the movie. I guess he's set up as kind of, he's not really the villain, is he?
No, because he
doesn't do anything particularly bad, I don't think. But he's just a greedy treasure hunter. You know, he's the one who stops all the models and that getting killed. So he's not a bad guy, but he is like, you know, Fred out of Scooby-Doo if he took a wrong path in life, and instead of solving mysteries, he went to seek treasure, and he's got his little a couple of follower guys who help him out on the treasure hunt, and it's one of them who first comes a cropper and gets killed. I think, is that the first kill where he sort of gets crushed under the door and then dragged into the tomb?
Yeah, although initially I was thinking, well, the door's coming down on this guy because he's laying on the ground. He sort of is half in and half out of this chamber, and the door comes down. And I was thinking, well, that door's obviously going to crush him in two, but in the next shot, the door is half open again and somebody just sort of drags him away. So if he was crushed, there certainly was no sort of on-screen evidence of that as such. But yeah, he's the shifty one who shoots at the models and everything, and he ends up finding out that some of the gold is hidden inside the body of the mummy, which is Saphira Man, as you were saying before. And we have to talk about the fact that, of course, this is called Dawn of the Mummy. We've put it under the category of classic monsters. So, I mean, do you think that this fits into that category at all? Because there is that early part, obviously, while the mummy is still laying in the sarcophagus there, where he is covered in bandages. So I suppose there is a link there?
I don't know. I don't think we ever see the real sort of traditional, you know, bandages hanging off as he lumbers along mummy in it, do we? It's more like a guy with sort of stuff all over his face. And I think the him and his, I don't know whether they're mummies or zombies or whatever they are. There's a scene when they first kind of rise up from the ground, which is a real high point. You know, it's one of those scenes. It's one of those highs I talked about earlier, where you sit up and go, "Okay, here we go," because it looks beautiful. It looks, you know, gorgeous. The way they sort of rise up and everything.
Yeah,
I'm not sure how long it lasts, but when it starts, it's really good.
Well, not long enough, I think, because if you look at something like, I've always enjoyed, when it's good, the Italian take on the zombie. Because if you look at something like Zombie Flesh Eaters, for example, or Zombie 2, or Zombie as it's known in America, that I absolutely love the way Fulci portrays those zombies. They really look like they've risen from the earth. They're covered in the earth and they look rotten. You know, they don't just look like people who've been covered with a bit of makeup or whatever. As much as I love Dawn of the Dead, you know, at the time the makeup effects weren't as advanced as they were later on. I think the Italians did a better job in terms of the look of the zombies than even Savini did, and I know that's probably blasphemy to some people. I love that movie, but so we get a little bit of that here. I mean, I almost feel like this is more of a zombie movie than it is anything else, really, because the mummy himself, Saphira Man, like you say, the way I would describe him is if you can imagine Hellraiser, the way some of some of the characters, like Frank, for example, when he's got no skin.
Yeah.
A little bit like that, but instead of it being sort of this red, bloody kind of effect, it's very sort of murky and brown, and but you can still see his eyes. And but the mummy, for the most part, is he's like the Charles Manson of mummies. He gets other people to do his dirty work for him. He you know, strangles a couple of people, but that's really it. He doesn't really do that much else other than that. And I have to say, I mean, it sort of made me laugh a couple of times, really, when thinking back on it, because of course this woman Zena, this elderly woman who somehow is still alive, I don't know how that figured out, perhaps she was a witch or something, Tom, but you know, a couple of times she says, well, his undead armies will rise and kill, and she really makes it sound like there's going to be an army of them, and there's only about four of them ever shown at one time. I never got the sense that there was an army of the undead who were coming to get our characters, but I really enjoyed the shots of them reaching up through the sand. Things like that, I really enjoy. I wish there was more of that in there, you know, because those sorts of shots, I think you can do a really good job with that kind of thing. You can really make it look as if these things are coming up from the earth. And so, you know, major props to the filmmaker. I can't remember his name here. Let me have a look at the old Frank O'Grammer. Major props to him for at least getting some of that feel into it. But, you know, let's talk about some of our other characters a little bit. Now, this is where it starts to get into the bland territory for me. Do you even remember the names of any of these sort of random women, and you know, the one guy in there, the sort of heartthrob in the group, not the photographer, but the other guy, like, is there much that's memorable about them?
You know, I can't remember how most of them die. I remember a good sort of rubberhead death where I think one of the mummies comes in with a hammer or an axe or something and axes someone to the head,
yeah,
and you see it briefly and it's a rubber head and when the strike hits and then it goes back to being a guy with makeup on his head. But yeah, the people, I really just can't remember. There's absolutely no character to any of them.
No, not at all. It, you know, except for maybe, you know, a couple of the native guys there, the Egyptian guys, who have at least a little bit of sort of pep to them. But yeah, that really bland, you know, cardboard cutouts, I would say, for the most part. But you're right, that particular death, which is, I think that's one of Rick's partners, actually, the only other one who's alive. Of course, we talked about the guy who shot at the at our main group earlier in the film, and then we've got this other guy who managed to survive, and he's there cutting some meat in a butcher shop there, and in comes one of the mummy slash zombie things and sticks a machete in his head, and I quite enjoyed that. I mean, there's, like you say, it's a very obvious rubber head, no doubt about that, but quite good. There's some decent gore in this, isn't there, here and there. It's sprinkled in. I think I would have liked more of it, but it's got a bit of that Italian Fulci feel to it that I really enjoy.
That's the thing, it does sometimes, then other times it just doesn't. It's so mismatched in some ways, you know. Like I said, the cast are like a cross between the Brady Bunch and something from a shampoo commercial or something. And it sort of juxtaposed against this supposedly violent mummy movie. And it's a bit like neither one way or the other, you know. It's like there's no nudity in it. It doesn't really have a proper grimy feel about it either. It's sort of very much its own thing, which is good sometimes. And, you know, I'm not saying nudity, it needs to be there, but, I mean, in a film like this, of this calibre, with a load of models in the desert, it's quite surprising that it's not there. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is up to anyone. But I was quite expecting it, you know. It's missing a bit of that sleaze factor, I think, to really make the whole thing a bit more grimy, because it's quite bright. And then we get mummies, and it's a very confusing film for me, Chris.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely. And I think they make the big mistake of killing off Rick too early, because he's really the only person who, I mean, I was thinking, like you said earlier on, you expect him to be a villain because he's sort of built up that way. And I don't know if he's a particularly good guy, but he's not a particularly bad one either. And I was expecting him to sort of be the hero, because the only other guy who's really going to stand up for anybody is probably the photographer. And he in many ways is the sort of villain of the piece, if you like, because he's just an arsehole who wants to get the job done, doesn't particularly care about anybody else except getting the shot that he needs. And so I was really hoping that they'd keep Rick on until the end, because he was giving it, you know, he was giving it some welly where nobody else really was. But yeah, it's so we have that very tedious middle section where we're spending time with characters that we don't particularly like. And I think that's a big problem for me with this. But for some reason, quite a few films on this list, I don't know why it is, but they seem to struggle when you get to that middle section there. And then sometimes you'll get a good final act that kind of makes up for it a little bit. And that's what we have here. The last 20 or so minutes of this is where the film comes to life, and it's too late. You know, it's too late. And that makes me really sad, because I think if this had kind of woken up a bit quicker, you know, it may have been something to write home about. As it is, it really isn't. But those last 20 minutes, Tom, is where it turns into a zombie movie, doesn't it, really? It turns into a zombies assaulting a village, essentially. And there's, you know, a couple of decent bits of gore. There's an eye gouging in it that again, very reminiscent of Fulci to me. Some good stuff in those last 20 minutes. And I think you could almost fast forward really through a lot of the really tedious stuff and get to that and have quite a nice little sort of chunk there, a nice little short film that kind of showcases some of the, you know, the more positive elements about this film. But unfortunately, it just, you know, it's all, as you were saying earlier on, kind of lumped in at the end.
Yeah. They throw everything in at the end, don't they? It's like you got explosions, you got this wedding scene, which is a sort of little side thing that we never went down. I don't think we particularly need to, but one of the guys goes into town and meets up with some Egyptian guy who's having a wedding, and his wife ends up getting eaten by the mummy. So it does turn into a sort of zombie movie. Yeah, you know, there's explosions, there's fire all through the village, everything gets thrown at the screen, and it's like, oh my God, what a climax kind of thing. But I've just had to sit through sort of, you know, an hour of boredom to kind of get here.
Yeah, and you walk away from it thinking, oh, that was actually quite good, that bit. Why wasn't the rest of it like that? And that's my problem with it at the end of the day, is that I don't think it's fun enough until we get to that section. And that part is enjoyable. But you've got to slog through some really tedious stuff, some very bland characters. But, you know, the payoff of it is that you get to, you know, you get to witness some nice, you know, some nice bits of gore. If you like to see zombies feasting on people, you get a bit of that here. You get people chewing on meat, which is, it seems to be the, you know, one of the images we see the most in zombie movies, is people chewing on meat, whether it's fake or not. And we get to see some of that here. And we get to see a sort of final showdown, if you like, between some of our remaining characters. Couldn't tell you who was who, to be honest, Tom. No. Couldn't tell you any of their names at all. Couldn't tell you if I wanted them to live or die. But they have a final showdown with the mummies, Seferaman, and they lure him into a house there in the village, or some sort of shop, and they put some dynamite down and put some petrol on the floor, and they do quite a nifty little ninja move, actually, where as soon as he comes through the wall of the house, they kind of jump out the window and run down the road, basically, and then watch the house blowing up, and it's all on fire. And you think, well, that's it. That's the end of the mummies. The funny thing is that they don't ever say what happened to the rest of the zombies in this particular section. Like, we're just meant to assume, well, they've dealt with one problem and that's enough. And unfortunately, the film does something that I really don't like. And they do this a lot in horror movies. And I've never liked it, which is that we are to presume that they've gotten rid of the threat and the characters are really happy, and then the very last shot is in this movie is of Seferaman's hand coming up like dun dun dun, he's not really dead, which I don't like, because it's basically saying, well, so everything we've just watched for the last hour and a half has been thrown away. There's what's the point of it? The ending is worthless because the guy is still alive. So what have we actually achieved?
Yeah, it's a funny one that I guess it's so expected in horror movies that I don't even think about it anymore. But you're right, you know, but it's there with it pretty much every Nightmare on Elm Street, every Friday the 13th, and now this one. But
it is, but I also feel that those movies, yes, you knew, certainly when they were coming out, you knew, well, of course he's going to be back in the next one. But at least those movies gave you they gave you a little bit of hope that, like, you know, for example, you go from Friday the 13th part 4, part 5, part 6. At the end of those movies, Freddy is quote-unquote dead. You know, for the most part, they don't bring him back like, hello, I'm going to be back in the next one. You just knew that the next one was coming. Whereas in this, it's definitely a case of, well, you've watched the threat die. Everybody thinks it's dead, but oh no, it's actually not dead. So I've wasted 90 minutes of my life watching something, watching these characters fight against something that it is back. I can't, you know, and they can't do anything about it. It's, I don't know, maybe it's just... maybe it's something that I, you know, is a personal dislike of mine. Now, I always like it when a film ends with the heroes winning. And then, you know, sure, yeah, if there's a sequel that then continues that story and the thing is back, that's fine. But no, I didn't like that aspect of it. But otherwise, a good 20 minutes there. It's a bad film. It is a bad film. You know, there are moments that are quite decently shot, but it's super cheesy. The acting isn't very good. The dubbing, I've noticed that a lot of the exposition is in the dubbing, like when characters aren't, when you can't see their mouths moving, I can hear characters, like, you know, people explaining the plot as it's happening to fill us in, which is fine, I suppose, you know, that's where all the exposition is. It could have been much, much worse than it is. I think it's better than Oasis of the Zombies, which was pretty terrible. This is terrible as well in its own way, but it's got some highlights, and I really enjoyed George Peck just losing it, Tom. Just losing his mind on set. And I wish his character of Rick had been around a bit longer. Character's not that great, really. But, you know, I enjoyed bits of this. I enjoyed bits of this. Certainly that 20-minute chunk there at the end, I think, is a decent enough highlight and is quite fun. I just wish the rest of the movie lived up to that.
I think we can kind of boil it down to two things, really. Earlier on, you said those early Egyptian scenes were like someone had went down the local fancy dress shop and, you know, just got dressed up and started filming stuff. And that's what part of it's like. But then you're out there and there's a pyramid and it's an actual real pyramid. And it's like, wow, look at that, you know. And that's what this movie is. Just such, you know, highs and lows, but unfortunately too many lows for me personally. But, you know, I didn't hate it. I'm glad I kind of watched it the once, maybe.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you are surprised when there are some good things in it, because it could have just been, you know, it could have just been something you'd chuck away. And it's not a film that I feel I would particularly watch again. Maybe that last 20 minutes, if somebody, you know, had a YouTube video of just that section, I think that'd be quite a nice little sort of zombie short film. But yeah, the rest of it, it's not quite doing it for me. But certainly we've seen much worse on this list. I mean, something like Wrong Way, for example, and films like that. You know, I mean, I would take this over that any day.
Oh God!
Any day. So yeah, not a terrible effort. It is terrible, but if you see what I mean, it's sort of entertainingly so, super cheesetastic, if you're into that sort of thing. But I would say, you know, trying to fit it into the category of classic monsters, I don't know if it's quite there. It feels like more of a zombie movie to me, I think. Right, so let me tell you about how you can get hold of this movie if you so desire. The film can be found on DVD in the UK via a release from Anchor Bay. Remember Anchor Bay, Tom?
Yeah, what happened to them?
They were fantastic, weren't they? I like to sort of think of them as an early version of Arrow Video, really, where they were releasing stuff on DVD that was... I remember buying The Evil Dead, the first uncut release of Evil Dead on DVD back in, I think it was 1998 or somewhere around there. And just being enamoured with them and thinking they could do no wrong. And unfortunately, I think they got absorbed by Stars in the US and possibly in the UK as well. And they, you know, Arrow Video kind of ended up taking up the mantle there. But yeah, quite an impressive company. So released from them. You can also find a a DVD in the US from Film Rise Studios. Now, perhaps the easiest way to see the film in America is on Amazon Prime Instant Video, where it is streaming as part of that service. So that's a pretty easy way to see it. I presume that would be the uncut version. I know the version in the UK that originally came out in the UK. I know Gore Blimey was saying in his feedback that, which you'll hear a bit later on, don't know why I'm spoiling it, but he said he had sort of an old version from a VHS tape, which I believe was cut by the BBFC. I would imagine the version you see in America is fully uncut. Be careful not to get the film confused with its remake. Believe it or not, Tom, a film of this quality was remade. The remake was released in 2015. It goes by two titles, Dawn of the Mummy and also Prisoners of the Sun.
Wow, I can't believe someone actually remade that movie. And I'll probably never watch that either. So anyway, why don't you take us on to our next movie, Chris, Werewolf Woman.
I know, right? It's absolutely bonkers. Yes, indeed. So it's Werewolf Woman, the second film in our double bill, released in 1976. It's got quite a lot of alternative English titles. Also known as Daughter of a Werewolf. I don't really get that one. Naked Werewolf Woman, She-Wolf, Terror of the She-Wolf, and The Legend of the Wolf Woman. Directed by Reno Di Silvestro. And it stars Annick Borel, Howard Ross, Frederick Stafford, and Dagmar Lysander, among others. Let me read you the synopsis here. Daniela Nazeri is a very disturbed individual. She regularly has dreams in which she sees herself as a lycanthrope, a werewolf. In the dreams, she's dancing naked in view of the full moon, and then hunting and preying on local townspeople who have come to find her, torches in hand. In reality, Daniela remains mostly at home, having become disturbed since learning that she once had an ancestor who may or may not have suffered from lycanthropy. We learn that Daniela was also raped as a young teenager, which only served to start off her mental illness. Daniela's sister, Elena, flies in from America for a visit, bringing her new husband along for the ride. It's clear that seeing the man stirs something sexual in Daniela, and she later witnesses her sister and brother-in-law making love. She shuts their bedroom door and walks outside, spurring Elena's husband to go and investigate the noise. He walks out into the surrounding forest area, where he's met by a naked Daniela, who seduces him, and then bites a gushing wound into his neck. He dies and Daniela is taken to hospital. Daniela's doctor is of the belief that she's suffering from clinical lycanthropy. She believes she's a werewolf and flies into a killing rage whenever she sees the full moon. He has her restrained and sedated as much as possible, but an opportunity to escape arrives when a fellow female patient attempts a sexual tryst. Seizing that opportunity, Daniela stabs her in the back and escapes, roaming the local area. She spots a random couple making love and pounces on the lady when she's alone, again biting her in the neck and leaving her dead. All seems lost for Daniela until she meets Luca, a polite, respectful man who allows her to come and stay with him. They fall in love, and Daniela begins to improve, feeling much calmer and more stable mentally. It's all about to fall apart, though, as three men sneak up to the house with the goal of raping Daniela. The animal in her is about to come out as love, loss, and revenge all collide in a fiery conclusion.
It would be ridiculous to think that anyone could turn into a wolf on the night of the plenilunium and act like the beast, committing animalistic acts, sexual and demoniacal. And yet lycanthropy exists, my dear Count.
Are you suggesting Daniela is a...
Please be calm. The phenomenon has already been analyzed. It was proven, really. But considering that your daughter has never had manifestations of this kind before, that which occurred last night, to be certain, was determined after she'd read that old fable, and particularly when she found that her ancestor, the protagonist of this weird fable, had a remarkable resemblance to her.
So, Tom, Werewolf Woman, Daughter of a Werewolf, Naked Werewolf Woman. What did you think of this one?
Well, Naked Werewolf Woman, we could certainly call it that because she does spend quite a bit of time in that way. I mean, this ticks a few boxes for me. It's quite sleazy. It's got a bit of that kind of Italian madness to it. Is it an Italian movie? Or
It is, yeah.
It is? Okay. So it's sleazy. It's got a bit of that madness to it. It even has an element of that thing that we've spoke about many times, where we like to watch someone become an unhinged, you know, the maniacs of this world, the Christmas evils. And I don't rate it as highly as those, mm-hmm. but there is that element to it. Again, I'm not quite sure if fits its running time as much as I would have liked, but I don't know. I did like it, you know. It's a fun sort of sleazy slice of exploitation, And we'll get into the details. But that's my overall kind of thought about it. What about you?
Right, fair enough. I think, Tom, I know a few people who really like this. Chief among them is Mr. Chris Ward from the Ancient Slumber podcast. He does there alongside Mr. Myron Schmidt. And known Chris for quite a long time. Used to be a fan of my old shows, and I believe yours as well, and stuck around for quite a long time. And he actually furnished us with a copy of this. That's how we got to see it. So thank you very much, Chris. Now that said, I think I'm going to be the outlier on this because I really didn't like this very much at all. Like it took me 3 sittings to get through this. I have to be honest with you, I kept having to have a break from it because I found it so mind-numbingly boring. I recognize some of the things that people are saying, it yourself included, about it. I see the sleazy element. I mean, I've always enjoyed a bit of Euro sleaze. You know, I at one point we were going to do a show that focused on Euro horror, and we were going to sort of, if you remember, Tom, when we were discussing the ideas for what we wanted to do together, we sort of explored the idea of maybe having a show that was just dedicated to Euro horror. So it would be, you know, stuff from Italy, Spain. We'd cover all sorts of different countries within that bracket. And so I do tend to enjoy stuff like this. And of course, that includes, you know, Gialli. I'm a big fan of the Italian Giallo, which do tend to be quite, you know, they take their time to get going. I mean, if you look at something like Deep Red by Dario Argento, Profondo Rosso, I mean, it's a long movie. And it takes a while to get going. So why is it that I like that, but yet this I struggle with? I don't know. I think one of the things that I didn't like, for me, perhaps it's a divisive thing. People seem to be on her side, and I'd be interested to hear your take on it. But I didn't particularly like Annick Borel in this. I found her to be quite screechy and annoying. And because she's the character that we see the most of, she is the werewolf woman. In the title, it lives or dies by that. And for me, it wasn't quite working for me. When she would fly into her rages, I just wanted her to be quiet, Tom, to be honest with you. I just wanted a bit of peace and quiet, and I wasn't having it. I think I expected it to be more of a classic monster movie. Really, all we get at the beginning is that sort of dream sequence where she's dreaming that she is a werewolf woman, and she's basically, they sellotape some bits of fur to her. You know, she's got some furry nipples. And in that early section, we see some of that sleaze there because there are a couple of times when she's doing that naked dance at the beginning, like I say, in the dream sequence, where they zoom in on her crotch, like a couple of times, like full on kind of shots, like this is this lady's vagina. And it's like, well, thank you very much. You know, so that sleazy element in there, they're definitely trying to linger on it. And it's, I would say there are several moments in the film where there's a little bit of a softcore sort of porn edge to it. Now, I have to say, another aspect of this film that annoyed me on a purely shallow level is that nobody makes love this slowly, Tom. And it's been happening in films for years, and I know that. And I know there is eroticism to sex. You should look at me in the bedroom, Tom. I am erotic as fuck. But nobody makes love that sexual intercourse is about friction, Tom. You can't frick somebody when you're moving that slowly.
I can't remember what you're talking about.
The sex scenes where
and there's a lot of sex scenes in it, but I didn't sit there and think, oh, that's some slow sex.
Perhaps you should have, Tom, because it was bothering me enormously. But no, that's not the reason why I didn't dig this movie. To be perfectly honest with you, I just want somebody to talk about, Tom. I need somebody to talk to. I'm lonely. I just found it boring. And that's the crux of it. You know, all the scenes where the doctor's there and he's describing the, you know, clinical lycanthropy, which, by the way, is a real thing.
Really?
Yeah, it's actually a real thing. And I think I knew that before because I think I'd read about it before and completely forgotten. And when I was doing some research on the film to find out a few bits and pieces and sort of get all the notes together, I read up about the fact that it is indeed a real thing. Some people really do believe that they are werewolves, and they believe that, you know, when there's a full moon in the sky, they believe that they have the ability to turn into one. And it's a mental condition. So in that aspect of the film, it is quite fascinating in that they are dealing with somebody who is not a werewolf, first of all, is not a monster, but is actually mentally ill.
Yeah.
And I think that aspect of it is fascinating. I just was not that interested. That, you know, there's a bit near the end here, which we'll get to as we sort of move through the plot, because I know you're going to be more appreciative of this film than I am. But there's a bit near the end here with some revenge that happens. That's the only section of the film that I really enjoyed, I would say. The rest of it just kind of passed me by. Like I said, it took me 3 seconds to get through it. For some reason, it just didn't happen for me, Tom.
The beef sometimes where I would sit here and say, okay, Chris, you know, fine, that's your opinion, but I really think this is a good, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. This is not one of those times, to be honest. It's, I could really see how it wouldn't work for some people. I actually found whatever the actress's name to be quite effective in the role, mm-hmm. you know, that detachment she had. She had quite a canine face, quite naturally. I don't know whether they've made her up that way. She had sort of like flat features. So kind of looked like, you know, she was a werewolf. And again, that psychological aspect to it, I kept expecting her to wolf out through it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like there's going to be a time when she wolfs out. And I think there is one kill where, and tell me if I'm wrong, is the one kill where we do actually see a very sort of hairy and wolf-like through the movie.
The only bit that I can, now I may be wrong about this, because like I said, it took me a couple of sittings to get through it, so don't rely on me completely, but I think the only scene that I can remember actually looking anything like a wolf was in the dream sequence at the beginning, where she is dreaming that she's her ancestor. That's the only bit. I think for the rest of it, she just goes mental and attacks people. I don't remember her ever sort of taking on any hair or anything.
Maybe I dropped off and dreamed it, but I'm sure there was a sequence later on where she kills someone in a barn or something like that, and you see her from above and she's sort of wolfed out. You know, you see her all hairy, but I might be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that psychological aspect to it, that it is just all in her head, basically. And, you know, spoiler warning, but when it comes to the end, you know, there isn't some little scene where she turns around and her eyes are all wolfy, or,
yeah,
you know, she's got a wolf's nose or something, which is refreshing, because they kind of, you know, they stick to their guns about it, which I think is good. But like I say, I'm not going to defend it too voraciously, because I had issues with the pacing as well. I think the difference is the few bits of it that I did like maybe raised it up a bit more for me.
Well, I think I'm getting a reputation, and maybe it's in my own head, I don't know, but I think I'm getting a reputation based on the fact that, you know, we get a lot of feedback from people who really, really love trashy films, and I think I'm picking up a reputation for not liking those kind of movies. Now, which is simply not true, because I spent a lot of my formative years buying really trashy movies off eBay and blind buying. I spent so much money on, I suppose it's not that much money really, it was a couple of quid a DVD or whatever, but I bought so many DVDs that were just blind bought, really, of things that sounded a bit sleazy, and it might have been an Italian horror film or an exploitation film or something like that. So I do love trash, but I am fed up of a lot of these movies that we've covered on this list being trashy, but being really boring as well. Like, I'll give you an example of, I think I brought this up before, I might have even brought it up on the last episode, to be honest. I talk about this film quite a bit, but a film like Pieces, which is utter trash, but it's never boring. And that's my issue, I suppose, with some of these movies, including this one, is that you can have all of those elements in there, you know, the Euro sleaze and the sex and the softcore and a bit of violence, and you can throw all of those things in there. But for me, it's not interesting enough, and therefore doesn't work for me as a film, whereas I can see something else that's really, really trashy. And for some reason, it works because it's never boring. That's the problem that I have with something like this. Maybe I'm just getting burnt out on bad movies that aren't that interesting, as opposed to a bad movie that's like a car crash and you can't stop watching it because, you know, everything about it is really, really, really bad. You look at Troll 2, for example. You know, Troll 2 is a film that has a reputation being one of the worst movies ever made, and it is. But it's car crash cinema, where you're watching it and you're thinking, who signed off on this? Who thought this was a good idea to put together? And you can't stop watching it. And I'm not seeing that here. I'm not seeing that with something like this. I found a lot of it quite laborious to get through and difficult. And there are long stretches of nothing really happening. And like I say, some of it lives or dies, or whether or not you enjoyed Annick Borel in the role. And for me, it wasn't quite there for me. But I have to say, Tom, you know, you're speaking about the mental illness aspect of it, and that side of it I think is interesting. I think that's what raises it above a level. By no means do I think this movie is, I wouldn't even say it's a particularly bad movie. I mean, Dawn of the Mummy is a worse movie. This is, you know, quite competently made and all the rest of it. It just wasn't quite there for me. And we moved through it, and we're always sort of lumbered with this character. I can't remember her name, Daniela. You're either going to like her or you're not. And it wasn't happening for me. I mean, what was it about her that you enjoyed?
I think it was that detachment, that sort of mixture of sometimes rage, sometimes detachment. You know, she just had a quite bestial look about her, but not in a really obvious way. And I thought that was quite good. But, you know, you're right, that there was a lot of slowness to this throughout, and we won't go through the plot beat by beat, but basically there's a long section where she's sort of, you know, her sister comes to stay, her sister's boyfriend or husband is there, who looks like someone she's seen in a dream sequence. She kills him, and there's sort of like, you know, we go through the movie, she kills people, etc., etc., etc. But then she meets a man. Now, again, these films where someone is sort of unraveling are often have a section where the person who is unraveling meets someone who gives them a chance to come away from the edge, to sort of stop before they, you know, fall over into the abyss. And for her, it's this man who just happens to be a stuntman. And we're treated to this montage of, whereas in another film it'd be them like running through the park or eating ice cream. It's like, you know, first of all, she shoots him and he falls off a building, but he gets up and they have a hug. Then he jumps through a window and he gets up and they have a hug. It's like this sort of stunt love montage, which was just completely bonkers, but, you know, very, you know, quite fun as well.
That was a highlight for me, actually. I mean, in case we didn't say it, he's a stuntman. And he's like, yeah, it took me by surprise, to be honest, because there's one moment where, you know, he's this really nice, polite guy. You know, he doesn't try to, because she got picked up earlier on in the film by this sort of older guy who tries to rape her later on and you know, does a thing of actually announcing it, I'm going to rape you now. You know, horrible individual. And of course, she ends up biting him in the neck. She always goes for the neck, Tom. That's a weak area. You should know, Tom. And she always goes for the neck, but she meets this nice guy. And you're thinking, oh, this is really good. And then he's up like the top of like a, what is it? Is it like a water tower, isn't it? Or something like that, isn't it? Something like that, like a watchtower or something. And he's up there banging a nail in. And she just points a gun at him and fires. And he falls off at the tower. And you're thinking, what's going on? And then he smiles. And it turns out that there's, you know, there's like a something at the bottom there to break his fall. And he smiles. And it turns out that they just decide to do stunts together for fun, like every loving couple does.
Of course.
Yeah, a really interesting moment. And there you're thinking, okay. At that point, I was thinking, all right, this has gone off the rails, isn't it? But I'm kind of with this now. And so that whole section is interesting. And she finds a way, because she wants to be with this guy so much. They don't actually say in the movie how long they've been together, but presumably they've been together for a number of weeks anyway. And we then have the unfortunate part of this movie where it moves into a bit of a rape revengey kind of thing, where there are these three guys who have been keeping an eye on her from a distance, and they know she lives in this house, and her fella is out. isn't there, and quite a creepy thing really, of these guys dressed in black, like coming up to the house and sort of peeking in through the window, and she sees them there. They're there for only one reason, and that is to rape her. And they sort of break in and they start trying to take hold of her. And then her fella comes back. And of course, he's a stuntman. So he knows how to fight a little bit. And I was quite with it. I was like, yeah, go on, beat the fuck out of him. You know, I was really enjoying that. And unfortunately, he meets his end. They stab him to death. And there's a little section. It's not that long. It's probably only about 10 minutes long, where she decides to take revenge on these three guys. And that's my favourite part of the movie. Is when it turns into a bit of a revenge flick, just for, you know, and the sort of werewolfy aspect of it is, you know, it's put to one side. I'm sure some people who really enjoy this movie perhaps didn't like that, but they put that to one side for a moment, and we just get to see this woman who is a woman scorned, who is obviously deeply saddened by the fact that her lover was taken from her, and she enacts revenge on these three guys, and she does so. One of them works on like a construction site. And there's a crane there, and she manages to, one guy she beats to death with a wrench when he's going inside the car. And then his friend, who's again one of the other rapists, comes to investigate, sees the dead body, he's crawled inside the car, and she grabs hold of the crane and basically, you know, kind of crushes the car and, you know, drops it from a great height and all the rest of it. And then the other piece of revenge is, you know, the guy who actually stabbed her fella to death, she sets his house on fire and burns him to death. And that was where it really picked up for me, and I really enjoyed that part of it. And then of course we get to the finale. So I suppose from that point onwards, I mean, there was only about 15 minutes left in the movie, to be honest with you. From that part onwards, I sort of didn't mind it. That was the section I enjoyed the most anyway.
I think we might as well skip to the end, because we're pretty much there, because I mean, near the end, she goes into the forest.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a ring of fire, and the cops arrive and they take her away. And we find out her dad committed suicide and her sister ended up in a mental institution, which is, you know, fine, whatever. But, you know, not the most amazing of climaxes. But again, I was quite happy that they didn't just have that final moment where she wolfed out, and it was like, oh my god, she is actually a wolf, you know, and they kind of stuck to their guns. That's pretty much what I take from it.
Yeah, I suppose in a way it's a more realistic ending to it. It doesn't turn into fantasy at all, which I respect it for that. I mean, we don't get that many good werewolf movies. I don't know if this could be counted as one of them. I'm sure that some people would say that it is. I mean, this came out, what, I think a couple of years before An American Werewolf in London, which set the standard as far as I'm concerned. And it, in many ways, I think, has still not been beaten. I don't think the werewolf transformation in An American Werewolf in London, I don't think has been beaten, even with the advent of better technology we have now. I mean, another film that I would say I really enjoyed in that subgenre, if you like, is Ginger Snaps, which is a modern horror movie, or strange to think of it as modern. I mean, it came out in the late 90s, didn't it? Quite a while ago now. But and that deals with female werewolves, which doesn't happen that often, really. So you have to give this film some credit for that. Is that the protagonist, if you can call her a protagonist, chiefly, you know, is a woman. So there's that aspect of it. And yeah, the finale is, you know, we discover that there's a voiceover from the cop. There's this detective character who sort of pops up towards the end of the movie, who we'd never seen before, and kind of becomes the main, you know, the other main character in it other than her. And he reveals in a voiceover where her father ended up committing suicide, her sister ended up in a mental hospital. And at the end of the movie, even though she's you know, lit this ring of fire around her, I had a ring of fire the other week, Tom, but it was curry, it's different. Even though she's lit this ring of fire, she hasn't lit it very well, because the cops just come right on through it and they take her away. And you sort of think, okay, well, obviously she's going to end up sectioned, and that'll be the end of a very sad life, really, that was just full of death and sadness. So I suppose in that respect, really, it's quite a downbeat ending.
I don't think I've got much to say else on it. You know, we disagree on this one, but I kind of, you know, don't disagree so voraciously that I would try to challenge your opinion on it. So, you know, fair play. But yeah, there's a lot of aspects I liked about it, but it was a very slow movie from me. That sleaze and that those really trashy Euro horror elements to it weren't there in enough abundance for me to really get on with it.
Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely fair enough. And, you know, listening to the feedback that you're going to hear in just a moment here from Chris Ward, who really enjoys this movie and, in fact, bought the Blu-ray and imported the Blu-ray, which I looked online, it costs about 18, 19 quid to import it from America. I hear the passion for it, and I want to be able to say that I saw the same film as him and the same one that you did. And I did, but it's just, like I say, you can line up 10 people, get them to watch a film together, and all of them may take different things out of it. And it just wasn't happening for me, this one. I would say if I was going to rewatch either one of these, it would have to be Dawn of the Mummy, because even though it is, you know, that 20 minutes, I think, is better than anything that's in this, really. But that's just me. That's just me.
So how can people get hold of this one?
Well, Tom, the film was released on Blu-ray in the US via Raro Video. I'm going to say Raro Video. This is a region-free release, which can be imported on Amazon if you live outside the US. The film was also released on a Region 1 DVD. Shriekshow released a Region 1 DVD box set entitled Wicked Women, which comprises of Werewolf Woman, Flesh for the Beast, and Nightmares Come at Night. I don't know if I've seen either of those. But so you can get hold of it. And yeah, like I say, Chris Ward was telling me that he managed to pick up the film on Blu-ray and really enjoyed it in that format. And certainly the Blu-ray seems to be quite good in terms of picture quality. And apparently there's a commentary track on there from the director who, going back to something you said early on in your review, he cast this woman in the lead role because he thought that she looked like a wolf. So there it is, really. More you say about that?
I say, let's have a listen to some feedback.
Howdy again, chaps. It's Andy Roberts here, so we'll start with Dawn of the Mummy. It opens up with a suitably cheesy opening, with a stereotypical Egyptian woman defending the cruel Sephra man after his death, sometimes even without moving her lips. After another cheesier credits montage, our group of models are actually too busy picking their feet or rolling joints to marvel at the Egyptian pyramids around them. I'm actually impressed that they could shoot on location. It really lifts the film a notch. A severed head causes an actress to scream and contort incredibly weirdly. She doesn't even think to just get up and run away. A group of treasure seekers have a box with a silly red skull on it. I guess it's important, we never really find out. The pack leader reminds me of the similar guy in Oasis of the Zombies. He was German and a treasure thief too. His lackey is absolutely hilarious when he's attacked by a rat, which is clearly a mouse, wailing about the curse. I love how our models go over and meet the thieves when they've just been shot at by Mr. Curse. I don't believe the photographer that his permit allows him to just waltz into tombs wherever he wants to, though I like the little touch that it's actually the lights that revive the mummy. Mr. Curse is the first one to die, but unfortunately it's a bloodless crushing, and after some badly synced singing, the models discover a mutilated horse, and then encounter the first zombie. The makeup makes for some interesting zombies. It's a bit distinct from Fulci's and Romero's. And oh come on, as if that model is actually impressed when Rick creepily gropes her neck while she's sleeping. The pace is really quite slow about the 50-minute mark, and it's not due to the sheesh pipes that people are smoking. Fortunately, it seems to increase once one of the crooks is dispatched by Sephira Man with a meat cleaver. A model is chased, bitten in the neck and then dragged into the sands. A twitching, overacting Rick is choked and decapitated by Sephira Man, thankfully. And the rude, idiotic pillock of a photographer has his throat ripped out and his innards satisfyingly torn out. The zombies attack in full force, turning a bride into the wedding feast. Eyes are gouged, flesh is ripped. It gets pretty intense and gory, and I felt I really enjoyed this one after the pace picked up. The high gore level, the zombie theme, and the shot of the mutilated but thankfully fake horse probably landed this one on section 3, I'm guessing. Now on to Werewolf Woman. A very interesting start, a butt-naked lady doing a wild fever dance before turning into a wolf werewolf creature. The facial makeup is very reminiscent of Norman J. Warren's film Prey. It's a really well-executed beginning that culminates in an axe hacking. The Doctor's pretty ridiculous, saying that lycanthropy exists. He didn't even think about it for a second, although his moustache does allow me to forgive him. Can you really blame Daniela for being averse to men after being raped at age 13? Especially when the Doctor calls it an unfortunate circumstance. Daniela is acted with a really powerful dazed and detached edge. She's really believable as a mentally damaged woman, and the sexual aspect really fits in with the werewolf motif, as well as the mental illness theme, although the scene where she looks in on her sister and her husband having sex is very similar to Emmanuel and the Last Cannibals, though with a slightly less sultry tone. Couldn't help but laugh when one of the Doctor's patients gets excited about showing him her breast. Daniela's performance when her sister visits goes from 0 to 100 in mere seconds. She practically froths at the mouth, hurling abuse at her. The mental case who comes into copper feel of Daniela is more than a little creepy and unnerving, and is thankfully stabbed for her rapaciousness. On her way out, she brutally bludgeons a driver of a car by slamming her head into a steering wheel. So far, it's basically a lot of sexy time followed by lunatic massacres, and I'm really enjoying the madness of it all. Daniela finds some totty to bounce around with, only to change her mind, causing him to exclaim happily, "Oh, I see, you wanna play? You want me to rape you? Yeah, I'd like that." Thankfully, she soon encounters a more decent bloke, and she doesn't quite know how to process it. But there's a horrible rape scene after this, which was really uncomfortable to watch, and the decent chap is actually murdered. After this, I couldn't wait for her madness to kick in again and for her to take her revenge, and she inevitably does. At the end of it, I really enjoyed this one too. Quite a nice character piece with some gore and sleaze thrown in. The rape scene and the combination of the sex and violence probably got this onto Section 3 territory. It's a really great pairing this week. I absolutely loved the pair of them.
Ahoy there, chaps. Chris Ward from the Ancient Slumber Podcast here. Just thought I'd chime in with my two penneth on the films that you covered on the show. Well, I say films, a film, because I've only watched one of them. Yeah, haven't watched Dawn of the Mummy as of this recording, but I will be watching it, hopefully, before I listen to your review of it. I thought I'd chime in a little bit with some thoughts on Werewolf Woman, seeing as it was me who provided you with it. Yeah, I first heard about this film a couple of years ago. I saw the trailer on one of the Grindhouse Trailer Classics DVDs that comes out from Nucleus Films. I think it's on volume 3 or 4, I can't quite remember. Yeah, the trailer really stuck out for me because, as well as being about 4 minutes long, it seemed to tick all the boxes. It had gore, it had nudity, it had some really bad dubbing, everything that you want in sort of 70s Euro sleaze. And it's not very often you see a female werewolf film, is it? So, yeah, it stuck out for me as one to watch, as I use those DVDs as a bit of a checklist. Yeah, so I went and bought a copy on DVD. Pretty cheap, around about a fiver. I picked up the, what's it called? Full Moon Films DVD, which is the version you have watched for your show. And, yeah, to be honest, the best bits are in the trailer, but it's not very often you get a 4 minute trailer, is it? So, you know, condense it down, get the best bits. Why not? Greatest hits. But yeah, I really like the film anyway. It just covers all the bases for me. You know, I'm not going to be all snobby about it because you read some reviews online about this film and people are very, very snobby about it. But, no, it's trashy, it's full of gore and sex and violence and naked people and big hairy nips and vagies and God knows what else. And why not? Why not indeed? I've got to be honest, I didn't know until I started conversing with the rest of the Strange and Deadly Twitter group out there that there was a Blu-ray version that was uncut. So I have purchased it on Blu-ray. Chris, you know that I had a few troubles with the original version that I bought because, you know, sending things from America, you can't always guarantee it's going to arrive undamaged. I did get another copy off somebody, and yeah, I watched it on Blu-ray last night, and I think it's fantastic. I just love this film. It's total trash, total sleaze. The Blu-ray looks brilliant for the most part. It's a bit shaky in some places where they haven't quite been able to get the restoration quite up to speed. But nevertheless, it's a full uncut version. It's the correct picture ratio. It's entertainingly, wonderfully stupidly, sleazily, greasy, disgusting bit of filth. And I love it. So yeah, there you go. I just thought I'd check in with you pair of perverts because it's been quite a while. And quite frankly, I suspect you're bored of just hearing from the American all the time, aren't you, really? So I thought I'd chime in with my two penneth worth. Look forward to what you're doing next. I think we've had a few, I'll be honest, I think we've had a few dismal films to cover. Not dismal podcasts, of course, I'd never say that. But dismal films seem to be getting better. Let's hope there's a few more diamonds in the rough to come. So thanks very much, chaps, and I shall speak to you soon. Bye!
Hello, gentlemen, and nice to have you back once again for our monster-themed double bill. Well then, of these two, for a change, I'd actually seen one of these flicks before. Dawn of the Mummy. And I have to say, I wasn't that impressed this time either. Yes, I know that last act is absolutely excellent, when finally the mummy and his zombie pals overrun some very crowded film set versions of the back streets of Egypt, but honestly, the hour or so before it is simply interminable. On the plus side, for a movie based around a fashion shoot, there's an admirable lack of boobies and gay stereotypes, but sadly, also, there's not much in the way of story or character really to keep you interested. And that's a bit of a shame, because the last 20 minutes or so are such great fun. And I think there was real potential here for a really good-munching spin on the old mummy, which sadly, most of the time, this film just doesn't deliver. Fantastic poster and video art, though. So then, on to Werewolf Woman, and I'll do my best not to mention furry nipples. Now, this one I actually found the more interesting of the two, because while it quite clearly had something of a exploitation vibe to it, merrily mixing lycanthropy with a kind of rape-revenge thriller storyline, I really felt that, despite the aforementioned furry nipples, this film was actually really trying to say something in its own grindhouse fashion about trauma and its long and profound effects it has on people. In fact, I thought it was exploring the themes of psychological damage and taking revenge on sexual predators so well, it was quite a shame that towards the end we did get a rather graphic rape scene, which I'm not sure the film really needed. But on the whole, though, a rather interesting movie, and certainly more worthwhile than several other werewolf flicks that take the psychological angle. Jack Nicholson's Wolf, I'm looking at you, you waste of space.
Hi guys, Gore Blimey here from the Trilogy of Terror podcast. Here are my notes on Dawn of the Mummy. I watched a very dark print of the film, which I recorded from one of the low-budget cable TV channels some time ago, and is probably a cut version. Hopefully it's not too different to what everyone else saw. Things start out well, with the High Priestess overacting her heart out, and who manages to cry out a curse on a mummy without actually moving a mouth. More impressively, she seems to be still knocking around the desert a couple of thousand years later, where she's taken the crazy Ralph role, warning people away from the tomb. Though, I have to say, she reminded me an awful lot more of Senna the soothsayer from up Pompeii. Over to modern-day New York, and we know it's New York because there's a montage with yellow cabs and people on roller skates. The top models in the city, yes, New York's top models, are going on a photo shoot to Egypt. So I guess these are the Naomi Campbell and Kate Moss types of the day. And before you can say, where's the Winnebago, they're bumping along a scorching, dry desert in a couple of old jeeps, sleeping in tents and making do with one makeup woman and a handful of outfits. They also drive right past the famous pyramids and decide to set up their photo shoot somewhere that looks like it might as well be in America. And curiously, it seems to be the only place in Egypt where you can find prickly pears growing. Meanwhile, we get a blonde-haired American tomb raider guy who, with his bunch of henchmen, is trying to rob the tomb containing the mummy Senna the soothsayer was all over at the beginning. And hard to believe it, but his acting makes even hers look understated and subtle. When the models discover the tomb, by basically just wandering into it, they manage to reawaken the mummy by pointing a camera light at it. which causes it to sizzle, bubble and smoke, and which nobody notices. And so begins all the fun. Highlights include a Flash Gordon lookalike American man sneaking into a woman's tent and waking her by putting his hand around her throat, which leads to her snogging him. There's also a scene where one of the models is running around the tunnel screaming in what looks like a nightie and a face pack. The film reaches its gruesome and violent climax with a big wedding scene. And no, you're not listening to me talk about Game of Thrones. The groom is possibly the most laid-back person I've ever seen. He casually says to one of the characters, "By the way, I'm getting married tomorrow, do you want to come?" And the next day he's like, "Oh look, there's my bride and wedding procession, I'd better go join them." Things really liven up though, when, instead of the usual mobile disco entertainment, they get a load of flesh-eating zombies who gatecrash the party, and we find out the bride really lays on a good buffet. And finally, it all builds to the big finale, where someone burns a shed down or something like that. The gore scenes that I could see weren't actually that bad, and I quite liked some of the zombie makeup too. There's even a few decent jump scares that took me by surprise. The zombie slaves coming out of the sand owes a lot to zombie flesh eaters, as does a particular throat-ripping scene. But saying that, I liked the way they made use of the hands in the sand to trip up and grab at victims, which was quite creepy. Also, some of the tomb scenes feel like a precursor for Raiders of the Lost Ark. There's even a melted face at one point. The pace gets a bit slow in parts, but it's still hugely entertaining. I absolutely loved the music, whether it's the speeded-up Jaws light music or the disco-funk Hey Mr. Boogeyman, Don't Stop Mr. Boogeyman, I really want to get that soundtrack. Yes, there are zombies and there is an oasis, but this is a whole lot better than that film. In fact, I had loads of fun with this cheesy chiller. It's right up my street. It's got massive overacting, funky disco music, supermodels being eaten by zombies, and the camp factor goes off the scale. I love this. It's definitely one of my favourites in the list so far.
We have two emails here from the Made for TV Mayhem crew, two members of that crew. First up is from Mr. Daniel Budnick. Always nice to hear from him. He says, first, thank you guys for mentioning my new podcast, Eventually Supertrain. It is much appreciated. You guys are super cool. Thank you, Dan. Werewolf Woman was a film I first read about in Phil Hardy's Encyclopedia of Horror Movies. It looked like it would be the best film ever, even though the book was dismissive towards it. I finally saw it about 10 years ago. Well, there's a lot of the leading lady being nude, and there isn't really a werewolf throughout it. And the leading lady is one of the most put upon women in cinematic history. It all made me a little sleepy after a while, but it does take time to stop for a beach frolic set to gorgeous music. The man she frolics with is a stuntman. He keeps doing stunts when he's with her, which I found hilarious. When some guys attack the leading lady and her boyfriend fights back, I thought that was some kind of fight training they were all doing for a film. Unfortunately, it's not. These guys are jackasses, and the boyfriend is solidly womped. Overall, Werewolf Woman left me in a strange, hazy, funky place. I don't think I liked it. I'll probably watch it again, though. It certainly fulfills my weekly quota for watching completely nude women dance. I'd be interested to know what other films are on that weekly quota, Dan. You must tell us. Dawn of the Mummy is 100% good times. I had remembered it being slow up until the end mummy attack. It is a bit. But I like the characters and their goofiness this time around. The movie felt like a TV movie. A TV movie that stars no one you've ever heard of, which is odd. And what about those mummies? Yes, they are more like zombies, but still, they scared me. When the poison gas in the tomb makes the faces of the thieves melt, that was pretty awesome. Favourite moment of mine? When the thieves are sneaking into the cave and they're trying to be quiet as they pass the drunken guards. But they just keep getting louder and louder. Dawn of the Mummy is 90 minutes of sloppy, silly goofiness that I quite enjoyed. Keep up the good work, you guys. And thanks again for the shout out, Dan. Thank you very much, Dan. Always lovely to hear from you.
We received an email from our friend Amanda Reyes, and she says, "Hi guys, this is Amanda again, watching Dawn of the Mummy now. I wish I had pursued a career in fashion photography because I had no idea you got to break into pyramids and have fashion shoots. Don't make the desecration of historical objects seem positively fun. There are at least 2,000 reasons that I love this film. I've always been mad for the models in peril subgenre. Maybe it's a bit sadistic on my part, seeing as how even on my best days, Vogue is never going to give me a call. But there's something about fabulous, well-to-do people meeting a grisly end that I just enjoy. Of the models in peril films I've watched, and I've seen a lot, this is one of my favourites. The premise is just so outrageous, but the cast is game, and the overall film is tons of fun. Obviously, the meat of the Dawn, no pun intended, arrives towards the end, but it's remarkable, and so it's worth waiting for. I also like that the female models look like actual models. They are lovely and not at all bad in their parts. The beautiful blonde actress was actually married to Roy Schneider for many years. Wow. Mm. And I wonder if he sat down with this film at some point. Maybe he thought to himself, Jaws 2 isn't so bad. Could you imagine that? Roy Schneider sitting down and he's like, that's really good. Well done, you know.
Brilliant. Having starred in, you know, one of the greatest horror movies ever made, to be in that. His name's Schneider, by the way, not Schneider. So I'd correct you.
You just ruined my joke.
I'm sorry, Tom. I'm sorry. You know what I'm like.
I really, really like the male model, although he comes across as a less authentic real-life model and is maybe more akin to something like an extra in Taxi Driver or The Godfather. He's got this great New York macho guy vibe, and I love how well he gets along with the locals. Actually, although there's a bit of antagonism between some of the characters, the main cast is mostly likeable, despite their threadbare characterizations.
Ooh, she's not going to like this, is she, Tom?
No. And the mummies are gruesome. It's just good times galore. And personally, I think this is one of the best films Strange and Deadly has covered. What? Okay, each to their own. Revisiting it again last week was loads of fun. This was also my second viewing of Werewolf Woman, a movie I remember being not as much fun as Dawn, but a good time killer nonetheless. I'm not sure what changed, but this time it just seemed kind of depressing. I guess all of the sexual trauma and the main character's hard knock life took some of the steam out of the cray cray. It's still completely outrageous and quite good in many ways. Props to the lead actress for not only bearing all with seemingly little to no discomfort, but also carrying that far off look of sadness throughout the film. This is one of those exploitation films that is a bit of a legitimate envelope pusher in terms of the nudity, gore, and overall obsession with sexual deviancy. Werewolf is interesting, fairly well made, and definitely has some silly stuff mixed in with the trauma and violence. I really love the stuntman montage where every stunt is rewarded with a big hug and a kiss. Best couple ever, perhaps. And the awesome 70s wardrobe is to die for, literally, apparently, and wow. Dagmar Lysander, who played the sister, is so stunning, I envision mummies chasing her around. What an interesting double feature, although it still hasn't cleansed my palate of Wrong Way completely. Hopefully the next double bill will. Looking forward to it. Take care, Amanda. Thank you, Amanda.
And we have a final email, just a short one here, from Benjamin, who's at VIP1990 on Twitter. Do you think he was born in 1990, Tom?
Maybe.
That is astonishing to me that somebody could be that young. Hi, guys, he says. I'm crazy busy with work and the wedding. You're getting married. Congratulations, sir. Congratulations. Yeah. So I thought I'd say thank you for the podcast and keep up the great work. And if you have the time, I'd love to know if you pre-ordered a copy of The Burning from Arrow, as it's now sold out across the board from Arrow and retailers. And for a bit of fun, how much do you expect the greedy eBay gits will try and flog it for, especially as it's now out of print? Keep up the great work, guys. VIP. One of the rare times where we've actually got something that we ask for, which is, you know, if you've got nothing to say about the films that we're covering, just write to us and ask us stuff about anything, really, anything to do with horror or anything you like, and we'll answer it. So yeah, this is interesting, Tom. I definitely pre-ordered the Steelbook version of The Burning from Arrow, and I told you about it, and I believe you put in a pre-order for it as well.
You would believe wrong. I considered it, but I didn't, because this is going to seem blasphemous, because I seem to be the only person in the world who doesn't really care for The Burning that much. I think it's okay, mm-hmm. but give me a Friday the 13th any day, to be honest. And so I thought, you know, I'm not just going to buy for the sake of it. But I think Vip's right. They're going to be, you know, the scalpers will probably have fun with this because the some of those Arrow releases are fetching big money these days. The Hellraiser one goes for a fair old price on eBay and stuff these days.
Yeah, I actually sold a couple of my my rare slipcase ones. Because I already have a steelbook version of it. I sold off my release of City of the Living Dead and a few other bits and pieces. And they do, you know, I'm not one of those people who's like, yes, I'm going to charge you 90 quid, please. You know, I just put it up for 99p and whatever it sells for. But they do. But some people really, I would never do that. I would never buy, you know, a couple of copies of The Burning and then stick it up there for 60 quid and hope somebody buys it. I think it's wrong. I think it's basically the same as ticket touting. I always, you know, put my rare out of print stuff up there for 99p and say, look, however much you think it's worth is how much you're going to pay for it, you know.
Our friend Andrew Roberts, he really dug this double bill, which is great. I'm glad we had put together a double bill that he enjoyed. He found Dawn of the Mummy cheesy. He was impressed with the locations, found the pace of it slow, but enjoyed that sort of finale that we both commented on. It picked up at the end, and we agree with him on that. And he was a fan of Werewolf Woman as well, enjoyed Daniela in the role. Thought that the scene of her watching her brother and sister-in-law having sex was reminiscent of Emmanuel. I'm not too sure. I haven't seen that. So Emmanuel and the Last Cannibals. I think that's just come out from 88 Films, hasn't it? And he enjoyed the madness of it all. And I can see that. Maybe Chris not so much, but, you know, good stuff, Andrew. Thank you.
Yeah, and Chris Ward there. Didn't get a chance to watch Dawn of the Mummy as yet. I'll be interested to hear what he thinks of that. But he owns Werewolf Woman, provided us with a copy, of course. Thank you very much again. He took that from the Full Moon DVD. First got interested in the film from its trailer, which seems to sort of suggest that the film had a little bit of everything for him. Not often that you see a female werewolf movie, which we definitely agree with. He thinks some people are quite snobby about the film, which I would agree with. You know, for me, I wasn't trying to be snobby about it. I just found it quite boring, but he liked the trashy nature of it. He had some trouble actually with, you know, importing the Blu-ray in with a company called All Your Music. He ordered the Friday the 13th, that lovely box set in the metal tin, and that was damaged, and then ordered this movie and that was damaged as well. So perhaps worth avoiding them if you're trying to import in some rare films. But yeah, Chris Ward is sort of, I guess, the most enthusiastic about this.
Yeah, he loved it, didn't he? He absolutely loved it. Then we had some feedback from Jim, and, you know, Jim seems to crystallize thoughts beautifully within 4 minutes, doesn't he? Like a poet. And, you know, he agreed that Dawn of the Mummy was bit of a bore, but he enjoyed the final act, and did his best not to mention fairy nipples for Werewolf Woman, but did it anyway. And he found the psychological aspect quite interesting in that movie, which I agree with.
Yeah, and finally we heard from Gore Blimey, who watched a very dark print of the movie. I think he might have watched the UK version of it, which was cut by the BBFC way back when. He thought that the high priestess early in the film was reminiscent of the soothsayer from Up Pompeii, which I think is probably a better movie than Dawn of the Mummy. Didn't think the gore scenes were too bad, like some of the zombie makeup, which I agree with. Some decent jump scares. Thinks the film owes a debt to zombie flesh eaters. I found the film very entertaining, especially the music, which you enjoyed as well, Tom, actually. It seems like if that one had a soundtrack available, that would be, you know, kind of popular. Thinks the film was a whole lot better than Oasis of the Zombies and says this is one of his favourites on the list so far. Yeah, so that's the end of the feedback section. Thank you very much to all of you for sending in your feedback as always. We really appreciate it. And so that's the end of that. And that's going to be the end of the show. Now, if you want to get in touch with us, you can do so on Twitter at Strange Deadly. No and in there. It's just at Strange Deadly. Tom, where can they find you?
Grindhouse Tom.
Okay, and if you want to find me, you can find me on Instagram and Letterboxd under under the handle The Chris Clayton. So it's The Chris Clayton. Tom, what have we got lined up on the next show?
I think we've got a nice double bill coming up. Well, not only a double bill, but actually a month that we might actually enjoy a bit more than this one. We'll see. But we've got Zombie Month coming up. And yes. Our next episode, we're looking at, well, it's funny, we've got, I don't think the next episode is obscure, but it's more obscure than the one after that. But the next episode, we're looking at Nightmare City and Zombie Holocaust. So we love a bit of zombie action, don't we? So this one should be a bit of fun.
Yeah, and it's revisiting, you know, one of the subjects of an earlier episode. And then after that, we normally don't sort of read you two in a row, but the episode after that, which will be episode 30, is continuing the zombie theme, as Tom was mentioning, with a show that's all about George Romero, with the films Dawn of the Dead and Night of the Living Dead. So there we have two, you know, four films there, very different in terms of reputation. And you could quite easily say that Night of the Living Dead is the film that made these two possible. Yeah, going to be interesting. So there you go. Coming up on the next episode of The Strange and Deadly Show, Nightmare City and Zombie Holocaust in a zombie theme. Thank you very much for listening, as always, and we will see you on the next one.
See you next time.
Bye for now. You've been listening to The Strange and Deadly Show, brought to you by Gentleman's Grindhouse Records, with me, Chris Clayton, and Tom Elliott. Thank you to Danny Davis for the music, and to Dark Ink One for the artwork. You can visit our website at gentlemansgrindhouserecords.com.